Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mumps. It's an uncommon virus, primarily because most people are now vaccinated against it these days. On average, the city of Columbus sees roughly one case per year. But so far already, 16 OSU students have been reported to be infected. Joining us now from the Centers for Disease Control's Measles, Mumps, and Rubella Division is epidemiologist Amy Parker-Feibelkorn. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Good morning. Thank you.
So what is mumps?
Mumps is a viral respiratory illness that starts with a few days of fever, headache, and muscle aches, and it's usually followed by swelling of the salivary glands, which can be very painful and make swallowing and eating difficult. Complications can also occur, which can include hearing loss or inflammation of the testes or ovaries.
How is it transmitted?
It's a respiratory illness, so it can be spread by people who are coughing and sneezing. It can also be spread from touching the same objects as someone who's been infected with mumps.
There's a vaccine out there. How long has that been around?
So the vaccine was invented in 1967, and we had a recommendation for one dose by 1977, and then in 1989, we started recommending two doses for better measles control. The mumps vaccine is actually part of a combination vaccine called the measles, mumps, rubella, or the MMR vaccine.
So if it was developed in 1967, that means people since then, most people since then, have been getting it?
Correct. So since the vaccine was developed until now, we've had a 99% drop in mumps cases in the United States, which is a dramatic decline in the number of cases. And that's largely due to the fact that most people are vaccinated. And we have school entry requirements. So kids who are entering kindergarten or first grade, or even kids who go to daycare, are required to get the recommended number of doses, which for school-age children, it's two doses, and then for high-risk adults, which includes university students, international travelers, or healthcare personnel, they're also recommended for getting two doses.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with CDC epidemiologist Amy Parker-Feibelkorn. We're talking about the mumps and the outbreak at OSU. So, Amy, having an outbreak of 16 cases in such a short period of time, does this raise eyebrows around the CDC?
Well, we certainly take into account when we find a cluster of mumps cases. And, you know, we work with the state and local health departments to keep on top of the cases and make sure that prevention measures are being implemented.
So around the country, right, is mumps occur primarily in the winter, or is it, can a cluster or an outbreak occur any time of the year?
It can occur at any time of year, but typically we do see it in like the winter or the spring or the fall.
Which is when kids are in school. And
correct.
Yeah. And are there other outbreaks like this out there? Has Columbus just been lucky all these years having just one a year, or?
So we have had a number of cases in recent years and that have developed into outbreaks among highly vaccinated populations. So in 2006, there was a very large outbreak that involved about 6,000 cases in Midwestern states. In 2009 and 2010, there was another large outbreak that had about 3,000 infected persons in the Northeast that was in an insulated religious community. We've seen outbreaks occurring in correctional facilities as well as among school-age children. So it's not entirely unique. I think the thing to keep in mind is that because we have such high vaccination coverage and, you know, the mumps vaccine is fairly effective, we've really been able to limit the scope and the spread of a lot of these outbreaks.
Will the fact that this is occurring, or we're finding out about this over spring break, be a good thing or not?
It certainly could be a good thing. It's giving the health departments a chance to, determine like what the case count is and put prevention measures in place and get up media attention and bring attention to the situation so that when kids return to the school after spring break, more people are aware of what symptoms to look for and, to seek treatment and isolate themselves if they start experiencing these symptoms, like once they return to campus.
You think that's what they're talking about down in Boca Raton and Fort Lauderdale right now? Do symptoms show up right away? Isn't the length of the period,
the incubation period,
part of the problem with mumps?
It is. There's a very long incubation period. It can be longer than 3 weeks. And so you could have contact with someone who's infected and then forget about it and then start experiencing these very common prodromal symptoms, you know, which occur a few days before the onset of the, you know, swelling of the salivary glands or the parotid glands, and not even realize that it was, you know, from a contact that you had 2 or 3 weeks earlier. And because these, you know, early symptoms, you know, before you get the swollen jaw are ubiquitous, they, you know, they're flu-like symptoms, mm-hmm. It's also hard to pinpoint, you know, that it's a mumps infection that's occurring. So that's one of the difficulties in dealing with containing mumps transmission and controlling outbreaks. Another issue is there's asymptomatic transmission that occurs. So you could actually get infected from someone who showed no signs or symptoms of mumps.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Amy Parker Feibelkorn, she's an epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control. We're talking about mumps. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Now, what if you're one of the people that got a vaccine back in the days when there was just one dose given? Is it recommended that those folks go out and get another dose?
So if you're an adult with one dose that, and it's a documented dose, that is sufficient according to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice recommendations. However, if you're what's considered to be a high-risk adult, then we recommend you get two doses. So a high-risk adult is anyone who is traveling internationally, anyone who's in a post-secondary educational institution, so if you're a college student or if you're in a tech school, those would be considered high-risk adults. And then if you're a healthcare provider, we would we require two doses for like those individuals.
Once you have the mumps, what's the treatment?
So it's mostly just supportive treatment. There isn't a specific treatment. You know, we just...
There's no Tamiflu or anything.
Right.
just to take care of them. And do the symptoms change depending on whether you're an adult or a child?
So a lot of times we have found that complications are more common in adults. So, you know, adults or anyone who is beyond the age of puberty is, you know, more apt to get a complication if you're a male called orchitis, which is an inflammation of the testes. And if you're a female who's, you know, in post-puberty, you're more, you know, you're at risk for getting inflammation of the ovaries.
You said it's the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine that they were combined. Were they always combined?
So in past years, monovalent or single antigen vaccine was available, but I think in 2011 or so, those single antigen vaccines were no longer manufactured. And so now all we have is the combination vaccine.
I remember getting the German measles, they called it, back a long time ago. Mm-hmm. What are measles and what's rubella?
So measles is a viral rash illness. It's highly contagious, and it causes a high fever and like a blotchy rash. And people who are infected with measles can also have complications, you know, including pneumonia or an inflammation of the brain called encephalitis. And then rubella is also a rash illness, and the issue with rubella is that if a pregnant woman becomes infected with rubella, particularly in the first trimester, she can infect her fetus, and the fetus can develop what's called congenital rubella syndrome, which is a triad of birth defects where that fetus could become blind or deaf or mentally retarded or else has heart defects.
Mm-hmm. So it's more about protecting the fetus ultimately.
Ultimately. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Amy Parker Feibelkorn, thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Amy Parker Feibelkorn is an epidemiologist at the Centers for Disease Control. Wellness Wednesday will continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Travel down the baby aisle at almost any store that sells baby items, and you'll find labels advertising BPA-free bottles, cups, and toys. But that BPA-free label doesn't necessarily guarantee a product is safe. Joining us now is the author of the recent Mother Jones article, The Scary New Evidence on BPA-Free Plastics, Mariah Blake. Welcome to the show, Mariah.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what is BPA and why is it in plastics?
BPA is a chemical which mimics the hormone estrogen. It is used in plastics because it makes them more flexible and durable. It is what is known as a plasticizer. So this is a class of chemicals that exists in plastics generally. The problem with BPA is because it mimics the natural hormone estrogen, it can cause all kinds of effects in our body. So estrogen plays a very crucial role in things like respiration, brain development, organ development. too much, but too much or too little of it, especially during critical phases of development, so prenatally, during early childhood, can cause the organs to develop abnormally and lead to disease later on.
How do we know this? What kind of evidence is there out there of this?
BPA at this point is one of the most studied chemicals on the planet. So there are 1,000 studies or so by academic scientists that demonstrate these effects. Well, that demonstrate these effects in animals for the most part. And now there are about 90 epidemiological studies that look for a connection between BPA and certain diseases in humans, levels of BPA exposure in particular. And about 60 of those studies have found connections between BPA exposure and certain diseases in humans. So it's really, there is no legitimate scientific debate about the health effects of BPA anymore. Or at least I should say there's no legitimate scientific debate about whether BPA is harmful. There's a lot of data out there, and there's stronger correlations with some diseases than there are with other diseases.
But there is controversy about it.
The controversy is mainly based on, so that there are two kinds of studies, essentially. Well, there's three kinds, but there are studies by academic scientists, and there are studies by industry-funded scientists, and now there's also there are some government studies that are emerging.
Mm-hmm.
The studies by academic scientists almost universally find health effects. The studies by industry-funded scientists never find health effects, so there has not been a single industry-funded study that has found health effects. However, if you look at the study design, in many of cases, it seems almost as if these studies were designed not to find health effects. So, for example, the industry-funded studies often use a strain of rat that is known as the Charles River Sprague Dolly rat. This is a rat that is very inbred. It is bred to be hyper-fertile, so they produce a large number of pups. They also have some sort of mutation that makes them largely insensitive to estrogen. So one Japanese study found that you can expose these rats to doses of estrogen 100 times higher than a human woman and find no effects whatsoever. So they're essentially testing a synthetic estrogen on an animal that does not respond to estrogen. So, and there are a number of factors like that when you look at these studies, raise questions about what kind of conclusions can be drawn from them. So the controversy, and I think in the public's mind there is controversy, but the academic scientists who study this, there is no debate among the academic scientists, or very little debate. It's somewhat akin to the science on global warming, where there is controversy, but among the people who study it, there is very little debate about the fact that there's global warming and that it is caused by human activity.
How long has BPA been in use in the U.S., and is it in use around the world, too?
It's in use around the world. It continues to be ubiquitous in the United States. I was in a restaurant yesterday, actually, where I realized the cup I was drinking out of was polycarbonate, so that contains BPA. So it has been in circulation in the United States. It was first formulated in 1937. It was formulated earlier than that. They first discovered it was a synthetic estrogen in 1937. Mm-hmm. So it has been in use in the United States for many, many decades. I don't know when it first started being used in commerce.
The FDA banned its use in baby bottles. I mentioned at the outset that you'll find a lot of BPA-free products, but recently published a paper saying it's safe in low dosages. So I'm trying to figure out, how do we get it into our bodies, first of all? And number two, how is the, mere mortal supposed to figure out what's a low dosage and what's not?
Okay, that FDA study, first of all, is fatally flawed. I'm working on a story about that. But the control group, I mean, there are a number of problems with the study. But the primary problem is that the control group was exposed to doses of BPA that were comparable to the low dose. So you're comparing two groups of animals, a group that is theoretically not exposed to BPA, and a group and groups that are, well, you're comparing multiple groups. You're comparing groups that are exposed to various levels of BPA, and then you're to animals that have theoretically not been exposed, but they had contamination in the lab, so the control group was exposed to BPA. So you're comparing two animals with comparable level of exposure and not seeing any difference in their organs, and then drawing conclusions based on that. The academic scientists I've been speaking to have basically said that the study is completely invalid, and that they would have discarded the data. So the consensus among academic scientists, or at least a large number of academic scientists, believe that there is no safe level of exposure to chemicals like BPA, and BPA in particular, because academic studies have shown that they create effects at very low levels of exposure. So they function fundamentally differently than other kinds of toxins, where you need a certain level of them in your body mm-hmm. to create an effect.
Does it accumulate?
It actually doesn't accumulate as much as some other chemicals, so okay. Your body metabolizes it pretty quickly. But because it especially during early stages of life, it can alter the development of organs permanently, even after it's left the body. It can alter your DNA, so it can alter genetic expression. And one way it does this is, for example, there's new research suggesting that it can turn off a gene that suppresses tumor growth. So this allows certain kinds of cancer to develop. And this is multi-generational. So if you're exposed in utero, not only are you more prone to cancer, but your children and grandchildren are more prone to cancer as well. So this is the thing that makes this chemical in some ways more frightening than other toxic chemicals that are out there.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with the author of an article about this chemical we're talking about, BPA. Her name's Mariah Blake, and the article is in Mother Jones. Talking to us from Washington, D.C. If you have a question or comment about BPA, it's bisphenol A, right?
Bisphenol A.
Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. There are a ton of BPA-free labels on the shelves now. Are these alternatives safe?
Well, that is an open question. There is new research suggesting that... Well, first of all, the issue with BPA, let me back up a little bit, is estrogenic activity. So it mimics the hormone estrogen. Mm-hmm. It also does some other things, but this is one of the main reasons that it causes the health problems that it causes. So there is an emerging body of research that shows that in fact many of the BPA-free plastics also have estrogenic activity. So this suggests that they may cause similar health effects. And there is actually only one plastic on the market that is marketed as being free of all estrogenic activity, and that is the plastic that I really focus on in my story to a large degree. And that plastic, according to the available data, let's put it this way, suggests that plastic may in fact be more estrogenic than polycarbonate, which is the type of plastic that contains BPA.
So is the estrogen, the mimicked estrogen, is it really coming from BPA or is it coming from something else?
BPA. BPA is a synthetic estrogen.
Right. But if you're finding the estrogen in other plastic products that don't contain BPA... What's the connection?
Well, there are a number of chemicals in commerce in the United States that mimic our hormones. They're called endocrine disrupting chemicals. So, in some cases there are chemicals. So it's chemicals that play the same role as BPA. So in many cases, for example, now plastics makers will use a chemical called BPS, which is structurally very similar to BPA, mm-hmm. and in cell culture tests behaves similar to BPA, which suggests that it may have similar health effects. I don't know how extensively it's been studied in animals, but however, there are other kinds of chemicals. For example, a colorant might cause this effect. There's any number of chemicals that are in circulation. I believe there's an estimate of as many as 2,000 chemicals that are used in commerce have these properties that they're estrogenic, and that does include the chemicals that mimic other hormones. So estrogenic chemicals, there's been more research done on them, but there's also research suggesting that chemicals that mimic other hormones also are associated with health problems.
Yeah, if there's that many out there, don't take this the wrong way, but why pick on BPA? There's so much out there. How do you isolate what the impact is on the population?
Well, the thing about BPA is that it just happens to be the chemical that Frederick von Saul, this scientist at the University of Missouri, studied. It happened to be a chemical that has been very, very well studied by scientists. A lot of these other chemicals have not been that well studied. So there's about 80,000 chemicals that are used in commerce in the United States. The vast majority of them have not been tested for safety. And chemicals are presumed safe until proven otherwise. So in many cases, so the researchers have done tests on BPA-free plastics and found that they have estrogenic activity. However, they don't necessarily know what chemicals are even causing the estrogenic activity. And so the reason I think we've picked on BPA is because there's a lot of science on that particular chemical, mm-hmm. and because the public became aware of the problem. That's really when things began to change with BPA, when the public began demanding BPA-free products. I think the potential risks of BPA-free products hasn't quite reached the public yet. I mean, my story has been making some waves, and you know, there's been some other reporting that has started to raise these questions, but there's certainly not the level of awareness that there is with BPA.
Since it's been in use and ubiquitously in use for so many years now, decades, has there been any correlation drawn between outbreaks of disease or anything like that? Has they been able to correlate it with anything in the population now?
Well, so the thing is that many of these are diseases that... I think the best answer to that question. So, in November 2006, the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences convened a group of 38 leading researchers from various fields. They looked at the 700 plus existing studies on BPA, and they issued a consensus statement that found that more than 95% of people in developed countries were exposed to levels that are within the range that are associated with all kinds of health problems in animals. So cancer, insulin-resistant diabetes, early puberty, increased aggression. And their conclusion was that there was great cause for concern with regard to the potential for similar adverse effects in humans, especially given that all of these diseases are rising sharply. So breast cancer, prostate cancer, insulin-resistant diabetes, obesity, early onset puberty. These are all problems that we're seeing with increasing frequency, and these are all problems that have been correlated with BPA. The difficulty, you never know in a specific case whether a person has gotten a disease because of exposure to one given chemical. But certainly scientists who study this feel that there's cause for concern and feel that this may be one of the factors contributing to the increased incidence in these diseases.
So what do consumers do? Plastics everywhere. I'm kind of looking around my office right now.
Yes.
Kind of freaking me out. But
yes. Well, I have a three-year-old son.
Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of us have kids who are now grown. We don't, you know, what do you do?
This is a question that I've been getting a lot, and I wish I had a better answer. I personally have made an effort to minimize plastic in my home. So I use a glass Tupperware equivalent. I use a stainless steel sippy cup. I'm actually, in the next week, I'm going to do a follow-up story. So I'm going to go back to some of my sources and see if I can figure out which plastic products are the safest. No type of plastic is guaranteed to be free of estrogenic activity. So there's different kinds, PET, peat, polycarbonate. And in the tests that have been done, all of them, in some cases, have estrogenic activity. However, there are specific products that do not. And there's not a lot of information out there about which products they are. So that is something that I hope to put together, a list of specific products that the available data suggests are free of estrogenic activity. But, you know, barring that, or in addition to that, I think, you know, in my home personally, I have limited the amount of plastic that is in my home, specifically food containers. But of course, there's no way to entirely avoid it. So, I mean, if you go into any grocery store, most of the food is packaged in plastic. I mean, it's just, right. It's impossible to avoid entirely.
Are you seeing companies working to provide alternatives because of this?
There are some companies that are trying to develop BPA-free plastics, or I'm sorry, estrogenic activity-free plastics.
Yeah.
However, they tend to be smaller companies. So I think for the most part, the big players, it's such an effort and consumer and expense, and consumers aren't demanding it. That was one of the things that came through in my reporting, that essentially, they know at some point they're going to have to change, but the change is going to cost them. And they're, you know, this is what my sources are telling me, at least. And so they are waiting as long as they can to make these changes. And you know, because they aren't required to test chemicals for safety. You know, in many cases they're removing the chemicals they know that are harmful, but what they're replacing them with, we don't actually know whether they're harmful or not, the replacement chemicals. So one of my sources described it as an unplanned science experiment that we're doing on our families all of the time.
Hmm. All right. Well, Mariah, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Mariah Blake, she's a reporter at Mother Jones's, and we were talking to her from her Washington, D.C. bureau. We will return with Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Susan Packard, the founding visionary network executive behind CNBC, HGTV, and the Food Network, joins us to talk about how building those networks taught her to build a team. That's coming up Thursday on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio Northern University. The ONU Explore Engineering Day is Saturday, March 15th. Families and potential students can tour the campus, meet with faculty and students of ONU's arts, sciences, and professional programs, and learn more about the ONU College of Engineering. Registration at onu.edu. And All Sides continues here on 89.7.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Gone are the days of the personal written health journal, you know, the kind on paper. Now you can just log onto your computer, plug in your fitness tracking device, and start tracking your activities, calories burned, motivation levels, even sleep habits. But don't chuck that paper journal just yet. The success of such a strategy depends on what you define as activity. Joining us now is a New York Times reporter who just completed a six-month review of health tracker gadgets. Albert Sun joins us on the phone from New York with the results. Welcome, Albert.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
What were you comparing the gadgets to when you started this, to each other, to yourself? Analysis,
well,
what?
When I first started, I was really thinking that I would find out which one was the most accurate. And so I was going to try them all and sort of see what counted steps the best and what had the most accurate reading of calories. But after a while, I realized that that didn't actually matter so much. When I was looking at the data from all these different devices, first, they all seemed pretty accurate at what they claimed to track, which is steps and overall activity. But what ended up being more important was how they made me think about my overall day and sort of how they could subtly prod me to be more active and to be motivated to move more and sort of change my behavior in little ways. And so the way that they were able to do that ended up being much more important in my mind.
Before you started testing these devices, how active would you say you were? Were you consciously tracking your activity before then?
I wasn't really consciously tracking my activity. I'd say I was a fairly active person. You know, through the summer, I would try and play tennis once a week, and I bike to work on most days, and I try and make it to the gym at least once or twice a week. But I wasn't consciously thinking about how many calories I burned in a given day or how many steps I walked, or I didn't really monitor what sort of foods I was eating or track my weight in any way. And so wearing these, it made me think about all those things, and now I sort of have this background knowledge about additional background knowledge about myself.
Listeners, if you have a question or comment for my guest, Albert Sun, reporter for the New York Times, he's written about activity trackers, the kind of gadgets you wear on your wrist and tell you how many calories you've burned or how many steps you've taken. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Also, if you have a tracker that you really enjoy and you think works very well, why don't you run it by us as well? You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You tested 11 models and wore mm-hmm. up to 4 at a time.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? Did you see a lot of discrepancy? Or when you say they were accurate, did they sort of track the same things at the same time about the same way?
Well, so the three most popular, I think, are the Fitbit, any of the ones that Fitbit makes, the mm-hmm. Jawbone Up and the Nike Fuel Band. Mm-hmm. And those three, and really all of them, the most common thing that's tracked is the number of steps. And so they were all at least within, I would say, 1,000 of each other, which, you know, if it's saying I walked 6,000 steps or 7,000 steps in a day, it feels roughly the same to me. I don't really care if it was, you know, 7,001 or 7,002.
Okay. All right. So, and they all are pretty much wristband type of devices.
Most. So there's one called the Basis Band, which is like a sort of digital watch. And that one's interesting because it also tracked my heart rate and how much I sweated on my wrist. And then there was another one made by Body Media, which was an armband worn on the upper arm. I think that one's used on The Biggest Loser, and that's the one that I actually found had the best calorie counts, I think, and it was the best overall at tracking all the different activities I was doing. And then some are also clip-ons. Like you clip them to your pants or your really wherever.
How do they work? How do they know how many steps you've taken? I guess I can get the heart rate thing, how they can figure those things out, but how do they know what you're doing?
So all of these are built around a three-axis accelerometer, and an accelerometer is, it's now a tiny little gadget, but they measure essentially how you move in three dimensions. And if you go to nytimes.com/health, we have a graphic where we explain this and show people doing different motions while wearing one of these. And so this is a little, you know, electronic chip, and they were first invented to, you know, guide rockets, and now they're also used in cars to know when airbags should deploy and for all sorts of other things. But essentially what they look for is they look for patterns in that data that the accelerometer produces that look like walking, and it's essentially a periodic, you know, motion at roughly the same time interval as the pace that you walk at. And so each time it sees that new peak, it counts that as another step.
Does it get more accurate over time as it gets more familiar with your movements?
You know, the different tracker makers, they all keep the exact details of their algorithms pretty secret. I think they do that, but I'm not sure.
They are keeping track of way more than just your movements. Some of them analyze your data and make suggestions based on your habits. What's that like?
Well, it's sort of, they give you little personalized anecdotes, and I think Jawbone does the best at this one. They'll have little messages popping up with summaries of your movement last week. Like they'll say you averaged, 6,700 steps, and Tuesday was your best day, or things like that. And they actually just released a new app where you can, if you log how much coffee you drink and you wear the band to sleep, it will tell you how the amount of caffeine you consume affects your sleep.
In what way? I mean, how will they tell you that you slept lighter last night because you had this much more caffeine?
It'll show you, like, if you've had more than, 300 milligrams of caffeine or caffeine in these certain ranges, you sleep on average however much or more or less.
You mentioned that you found one of the biggest aspects of this was the motivational aspect. Can you go into a little bit more detail about how it motivated you?
Well, so a lot of people try to set a certain step goal that they want to hit every day. And so that you can look at this device, one of these devices, and see, oh, I've only made it to, 5,000 steps a day. I better go out for a walk around before I sit down to eat dinner. Or, it made me build things into my routines, like going for walks in the middle of the afternoon to try and get a little more active. And, some of them will send you little updates throughout the day. Several of them have little inactivity alerts, they call them, where if you haven't moved in a period of time, like if you haven't gotten up from your desk in an hour, it'll buzz on your wrist or it'll flash a little message saying, like, hey, get moving.
That's a big deal nowadays to just get up every 20 or 30 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Just walk around. So simple. You found that when it comes to tracking some types of movement, a lot of these gadgets fell short. Like how?
So they're pretty bad at tracking anything that doesn't have a lot of wrist movement. So that means if you're bicycling, it doesn't do so well, except for the ones that have other sensors other than the accelerometer.
Why is that? Why can't bicycling?
Well, just because if you think about the position you're in when you're bicycling, if you're wearing something on your wrist is not really moving all that much. Some of them, they say you should, clip it to your leg when you're doing it, but then it would try and translate that motion into a number of steps, which is not really, the algorithms just aren't well suited for that yet.
I was wondering, are any of them special for biking?
There are companies working on one specifically for biking now, but I don't think there, I didn't test any of those. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there are any that are already on the market. There are, of course, specific apps that, there are bike trainer computers, and there are a range of gadgets specifically designed for biking. But these activity trackers are really intended to be used throughout the day, and they're supposed to give you an overall picture of your activity, not to specifically improve one exercise or performance at a specific sport like that.
And since you bike almost every day in the summer, for instance, that's not really coming out in the equation for you.
No, yeah. That's not.
Yeah. Anything else?
And so, yeah, I think the key thing that I learned was just that, these are an interesting view, but they're not a complete view of what you're doing. And so it's still thinking and having a bit of introspection about, what my activity is like. And then this is one view, and I combine that with how my body feels, and that gives me a better picture of what's going on.
Do any of them measure exertion, like if you're lifting more weight at the gym? Can they tell?
I think only the Body Media armband does something like that. And they have what they call a heat flux sensor, which sort of measures your skin temperature and how much heat your muscles are giving off. And so I found that one actually worked pretty well when I was in the gym lifting weights.
And so which was your least favorite?
Well, I don't know if I could say any of them were my least favorite.
Okay.
None of them were bad. They were all pretty good at counting steps and at doing that.
Uh-huh. It was just more a matter of personal preference at that point.
Right. It's at that level, if that's all you want, then they all do pretty well. But I think for most people, you would get bored of that after a few weeks or months, and it wouldn't be interesting anymore.
You said that some companies, some developers are working on trackers for bicyclists and stuff like that. What do we know going into the future? What is out there? What are they working on? What else are they working on in this realm?
You know, I think I saw there's one that's supposed to help you perfect your weightlifting form. There's one for airboxing or something like that. It seems like they keep popping up, and it's a little hard to keep track of all of them, especially at this stage before they're, you know, while they're still in development.
And how much do they cost? What's the price range?
So the cheapest one I tested was $60, and that's the Fitbit Zip, and that's one of the clip-on ones. And I think the most expensive one I tested was $200, and that was the basis band. That's the one that also measures heart rate and sweat.
And did that feel like fair? I mean, so you're not necessarily, you don't have to spend a ton of money on these then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So did it change you?
I think it did change me. I think I'm much more aware of my own behavior and my own health now.
How so?
Well, I can sort of estimate, you know, like today I biked to work, but I'm probably not going to bike home, and so I know that I'm probably going to take about 6,000 steps, give or take 1,000 today, and you know, that's an okay weekday.
Okay. I'm talking with Albert Sun. He's a reporter at the New York Times. If you have a question or comment for him about a Fit Tracker, I guess an activity tracker is what they call them, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The story just came out yesterday. Have you gotten any feedback from your readers on it, what they agree or disagree with on, or any ideas about what they're using out there?
I think I've heard from a lot of people that they've had similar experiences, and I've also heard from a lot of people who are very fit people and are very into some certain activity, and they're you know, trying to really improve at a certain sport, and I think those people feel that it's kind of lacking, but people who are just getting started and trying to improve their own health, they tend to like it more.
How popular are these anyways? How many people are buying them?
So I think in the story, I said exact sales figures are hard to come by, but an analyst I talked to said that they had sold $290 million worth in the U.S. last year.
Wow.
And that number is expected to go up this year by, you know, 50 to 100%.
That's a lot?
I think so.
It's
a very new market.
Yeah. We have an email from Todd. He says, I use my map my ride on my phone, and it will track all sorts of activities with GPS and estimates calories burned based on weight and the activity logged. As well, you can track gym workouts and nutrition. I also use a pedometer as I am participating in a live healthy program at work at the City of Columbus. Goodness, Todd. And all, they help me track training. The devices keep you active, and as you feel and see these improvements in health, you tend to try to maintain certain levels of activity.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that's pretty good. So what is the most comfortable to wear?
Well, the clip-on ones, once you clip it to a pocket or a belt, you can almost forget that they're there, to the point where you forget to take them off and they go into the washing machine accidentally.
Okay.
Of the ones on the wrist, they, you know, it's like wearing a watch. After a while, you just forget. They're all pretty comfortable. The Body Media armband, the one that I thought was the most accurate, that one was a little less comfortable to wear since it's a elastic strap around the upper arm.
Okay. Well, Albert Sun, I want to say thank you to you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's Albert Sun. He's a reporter for the New York Times. You can see his article in the New York Times. It was published yesterday, along with a chart about a guide to activity trackers. I want to say thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Julia Hyder, Joel Nadler, Leticia Wiggins, Emmy Beach, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me, Ann, on Twitter too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.